What I want to talk about the next couple of weeks here is, I was asked just a moment ago, a very good question, am I going to be asking you hard questions or am I going to be answering hard questions? And the answer is, of course, a little bit of both. I call this targeted apologetics, and that is, it is because I'm a nerd and I love it when Bob or Patrick or somebody gets up there and they start talking about ology this and ology that. You know, your epistemology and your ontology. I'm like, yes, feed me more. You know, I've read, I literally own everything by C.S. Lewis and I've read it twice. I'm that guy. But I've also found that a lot of people don't necessarily connect with that or don't necessarily even know how to use it. And so I don't want to say this is dumbed down, but again, I say targeted. Because in my time out there, and I would say specifically in prisons and in the military where I've been preaching and teaching over the years, over and over and over again, you run into the same objections. You have the same challenges to faith. You have people bring up the same issues of, look, I hear what you're saying, but I just can't be a Christian because of X. Or I talk to believers, and they're like, look, I want to believe, like the man talking to Jesus, Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief. You know, I want to believe, but this is just really tripping me up, this difficult question. And so instead of talking about simply arguing with an atheist, for example, you know, atheists account for 2% of the population. Agnostics are about another 3% of the population. So that's really a pretty small slice of the demographic pie. What I want to talk about is things that most of us have probably asked ourselves. And if you haven't encountered it yet, if you start talking with unbelievers, I guarantee you, you're going to start hearing this stuff. So, in this class, it may be a little different. I want to concentrate on keeping the classes relatively short. I don't know if that's going to happen today because I do have a lot to get into with introduction and part one. But in general, I want there to be limited information because I want you guys to have a higher concentration on one specific thing that we're talking about each week and higher retention of that thing because I want this to be discussion-based. I want you to be able to remember this and I want you to be able to use it. So, as always, please feel free to be honest and candid and throw your hand up at any point if you have a question or a discussion. Feel free to interrupt me. Please don't feel free to interrupt other people while they're talking. But really, do feel free to talk. If I'm up here and I seem too tall, I can come down here if I need to. I feel safe, protected by this little... This is why pastors do this, I think. We're just like, no one can like throw apples at me up here. Or tomatoes, whatever you brought with you. But yes, this is a place to support and encourage each other, so please be honest and open and candid. I encourage discussion. So, as part one of this, before we flip to the next slide and see what's behind door number one, I want you guys, with your said discussion partners, to talk with yourself and just get a feel for your own experience and in the lives of other people. What are questions that you have had or questions or objections or challenges you've heard from unbelievers to faith? Why can't they be a Christian? What doubts have you had in your own mind? I want you guys to kind of get a feel in your own little groups. What have you heard? What have you thought of yourself? These would be questions about God, about Jesus, about the Bible, about church, or about faith and religion in general. What have you encountered out there? What have you thought of in your own mind? So take a minute. Find your discussion partner and say, this is what I've heard, this is what I've thought. Whether that was 5 minutes or not, I'm sorry to interrupt any of you if you're still going. But what do we encounter out there? What are some questions you guys coughed up in your discussion pairs or trios? As Rich would say, okay, what else? Cynthia. And why is that? What causes that aversion? Have you had someone be like, I'm scared of you because you're a Christian who's living by the Bible? I'm not trying to be contrary. I'm just saying, can you extrapolate? That's interesting. It's not actually on my list. That's fantastic. This is why I ask these questions. I can learn something. All right, what's something else that you guys have encountered? And we are going to talk about proof. That's a very sticky concept. And do these people go into what offends them about Christianity? They just, it's a very vague notion. and I really appreciate this. This again is a forum for us to be saying, look, this is something that honestly bothers me, or that I've thought about this. And maybe some of us haven't had the chance to rub up against some unbelievers, or think some of these questions, have been too busy, or haven't read much lately, and maybe we're not aware of the fact that this stuff is real issues out there, and people really deal with this. So this is a forum for us to teach each other and to encourage each other and to kind of poke each other's minds. I'm going to serve as your sort of discussion leader, as it were, and facilitator. I have somewhere we're going to go with this. I have my own answers. But that doesn't mean that that's, you know, everything that there is to it. You guys, please feel free to contribute. So moving forward here, over the next 2 months or so, we're going to be answering some of these hard questions. And as we mentioned, the first bit here, the technical term for it is theodicy, which there's probably better definitions than I'm about to give you, but essentially this means it is the defense of the idea of God against that exact charge. How do you explain that there could be such a thing as a loving God when there is so much evil and so much suffering in the world? It's a huge issue. And I'm not going to lie here. I think this is probably the number one thing. Of all my time talking to unbelievers out there in various circumstances, I think this comes up more than any other single issue. So could be just anecdotal, just be who I bump into, but this is a huge, huge issue. So we're going to be addressing this idea of God and suffering, and the doctrine of hell is often very straightforward for a lot of believers, but believe it or not, a lot of unbelievers really get, you know, stumbling over this particular issue of eternal damnation. So we're going to be talking about that as well. Irrationality, I think, is maybe your number two charge here, especially for those of you who are in school and maybe brushing against some more educated folks. That's probably where you're going to bump it more into that 2%, 4% of the atheists and the agnostics, and saying, you know, how, on what basis do you believe in the supernatural? I mean, hasn't science disproved this? You know, isn't faith unreasonable? There's no ground for thinking what you think. There's no evidence. And this is some pretty heady stuff. Another big one, and I think this is my number three that I've encountered, is this question of exclusivity. You know, how can you say Christianity is still a true religion? There are so many out there. What makes you so right? This issue of the noble savage, if you don't know what that is, I don't want to go into it right now, but it's a philosophical question that needs to be answered. And after a point, it becomes difficult to rank these, because these are also common issues. Hypocrisy, why are so many Christians nothing like Jesus? And you look around this assembly, and you might be like, oh, but, you know, Bobby's a great guy, and Gay's a wonderful lady, and, you know, there's no hypocrites here. Well, we probably are more hypocritical than we might want to admit, but what about in mainstream denominations? What about some people who are nominal Christians, who wear that name, and drag Christ's name through the dirt because they say that's what they are, but they don't live anything like it? I feel like there's a lot of contributing factors to hypocrisy. But it extends beyond that simple moral ambiguity. It extends to a historic abuse of power by many people in the church. And this extends to a lot of levels, and this is a difficult and complex thing we'll be talking about as well. And finally, simple irrelevance. Why are Christians seemingly so out of touch? I want to talk about something that I call the Christian subculture separation. And then just generally speaking, you know, what have we to actually offer to society? We're often, at best, the moral majority or the extreme fundamentalist right, you know, even in politics. So I hope this doesn't paint too dire a picture, but the class is called Answering Hard Questions, and these are some really tough issues. And if we have time, we can pick up some of those other things that you guys even mentioned before. So feel free to email me or Facebook me or grab me afterward if you'd be like, hey, I'd really like you to talk about this too. We can probably work it into the scheme at some point here. So to proceed then, today we're going to talk about God and evil. Please don't look so depressed, everybody. That's probably inappropriate because this is some pretty hard stuff. But we have hope in God. The cross is the ultimate answer to this. I'll go ahead and give away the end of the lesson. So there is hope. There is reason for positivity here. But we're going to walk through some pretty dark stuff here in the next half hour. Theologian John Stott, I echo exactly what he says here. The fact of suffering undoubtedly constitutes the single greatest challenge to the Christian faith and has been in every generation. Its distribution, suffering's distribution and degree appear to be entirely random and therefore unfair? Sensitive spirits ask if it can possibly be reconciled with God's justice and love. So then what are the questions relating to God and evil? Because this is the issue, right? There's not just one uniform question out there. It's this attitude, this spirit, this whole direction of thinking that bubbles up in the form of a couple of different ways we can ask this. Any thoughts here as when you think God and evil, God and suffering, what would be a question you would pose? It's so obvious, right? I think you often hear this one. Why do bad things happen to good people? It's easier for us to look at, you know, Hurricane Katrina back 9 years ago and be like, yeah, well, New Orleans, you know, it's they deserved it, right? I heard a lot of people talking about it's just God judging the city, but can we say that? All the children and all the, well, you know, they're all born with sin. I know that, but like, is that where we go with this? There's an answer to it. This is something maybe more personal. Why is God allowing fill in the blank to happen to me? We were talking about this on Wednesday, this just sense of like, it just seems unfair. Why? I'm trying to be a good Christian. I'm trying to walk with God. I'm doing all the right things. I'm not even legalistically. I'm just following God's grace. And then, poof, you know, out of the middle of nowhere, some tragedy thing or something massively unfair happens. I think, technically speaking, you're going to see it framed like this in literature. If there is a such thing as a loving and all-powerful being, why does he, she, it allow such pain, suffering, and evil in the world? I surely hope that is our response. And I can say from personal experience about 6 years ago now, I was in a situation where I lost everything. I lost my job. I lost my fiance at the time. I lost my home. I basically drove off with a car and my stuff in the back, and that's it. I had to move back with my parents at like 23, I guess I was. Very embarrassing, soul-crushing. I had nothing at all. And God just led me to the point that summer where he was like, all you have left is me, and that's a really good position to be in because, you know, like C.S. Lewis says, you know, if you have Jesus, you get everything thrown in. If you have Jesus plus something, you get nothing at all. That's a paraphrase if you're a C.S. Lewisophile, which, he drove me to the scriptures, and I searched the scriptures, and I found a lot of grace and encouragement and growth there, but that had to be a response. You know, spiritual growth doesn't happen automatically when bad things happen to you. And you're right, that is for believers. The larger implications for everybody, believer or not, is difficult. And you're right, I think most of us here, maybe all of us here, would profess to be believers, but that's not something any of us should ever assume, is it? And I'm not saying that you were, but I mean, it's obvious. Well, we're in church, why wouldn't we be? But I want us also, as we phrase things here, to be careful with some, maybe there is someone who's struggling here, maybe there's someone who's doubting here, maybe someone here isn't a believer or has never been a believer. We want to be sensitive to those opinions. And if you're not, please feel free to candidly express your questions and your doubts. We're here for honesty. I appreciate what you said earlier about suffering. Christian journalist Lee Strobel wrote about this experience. He said, "Nothing shocked me as much as my visit to the slums of Mumbai, India. Lining both sides of the noisy, filthy, congested streets, far as the eye could see, were small cardboard and burlap shanties situated right next to the road where buses and cars would spew their exhaust and soot. Naked children played in the open sewage ditches that coursed through the area. People with missing limbs or bodies contorted by deformities sat passively in the dirt. Insects buzzed everywhere. It was a horrific scene. A place where, one taxi driver told me, people are born on the sidewalk, live their entire lives on the sidewalk, then die a premature death on the sidewalk. I then came face to face with a 10-year-old boy about the same age as my son Kyle at the time. The Indian child was scrawny and malnourished, his hair filthy and matted. One eye was diseased and half-closed, the other stared vacantly. Blood oozed from scabs on his face. He extended his hand and mumbled something in Hindi, apparently begging for coins. But his voice was a dull, lifeless monotone, as if he didn't expect any response, as if he had been drained of all hope. Where was God in that festering hellhole? If he had the power to instantly heal that youngster, why did he turn his back? If he loved these people, why didn't he show it by rescuing them? Is this, I wondered, the real reason? Because the very presence of such awful, heart-wrenching suffering actually disproves the existence of God and loving Father. When difficult things happen to us, as believers, we have that response. We can look toward the discipline that God is bringing into our lives. But what about the just mass suffering everywhere else? We might not see a whole lot of it, relatively speaking, in America. I mean, just reading this makes me so humbled and thankful. I drove here in an air-conditioned car. I'm wearing clean clothes. I'm wearing clothes. You know, and well, yeah, that's a good thing. You know, I'm not going to go there. And so, how would you then respond to that? Just right off the cuff, then. Perfect. We're going to go there in just a second. Not only is that theologically accurate and incredibly helpful, we're going to get to it in just a second. But to that, I would also ask then, suppose you're Lee Strobel on the streets of Mumbai, and you see this naked little boy begging for coins. And you can share the gospel with him, and you can say, hey, this is our sin, and this is what causes it. But then what do we do with it from there? It's a really hard question, right? That, I don't know, has a straight, easy answer. Patrick? It's a very, very interesting question. And I think this is the hardest question that we're going to be tackling. I don't intend to cry multiple times on stage. But yes, it makes me angry. I read this to highlight that because, again, I drove here in an air-conditioned car. I'm a privileged and wealthy person by any standard. And I would dare say every single one of you are probably as well. But then, so what do we do with this? It's not a reality that we're confronted with every day. So I feel sometimes as believers to really feel the implications of a verse as simple as John 3:16. You know, God loved the world, so he did something about it. And I'm sorry that's giving away the answer, but that's where we're going with this. But we're gonna have to get there. But before we get to the good part, I want to start asking these questions. What is the conclusions people draw? They ask these questions, they grasp for an answer, and then this is where it goes. They conclude that maybe God just isn't loving. Maybe God just isn't good. Maybe there is an all-powerful being out there, but he just doesn't care.
He's hands-off.
Right. Maybe he's just, maybe he's not near. He's just distant, you know, like a deist or a more general theistic view might take this role. For most of us, we probably don't think this exactly because doctrinally we know God is loving, God is powerful. But it comes to us kind of in the middle of the night when we're staying awake over some difficult thing we're struggling with. We're just like, God, do you even care about me? Like we know otherwise, but it's a very real feeling that we have. Yes, sir. Oh, you're giving the answers away again. You can't serve God and mammon, right? I mean, it's one or the other. I mean, one of these things is going to fill you. This is the most common responses, but then you also get this one. Maybe God's just not there at all. And again, I don't want to frame this class, and especially even this lesson, in terms of this is what you tell an atheist. Although, this is a very good discussion to have with an atheist. Because they're just, again, a small piece of the people who are going to struggle with this. I mean, Patrick, how long have you been a Christian?
Since I was 7.
Decades. And yet, here I am angry and not sure how to deal with this, even though you have stood here and taught on probably this exact topic. It still baffles us. In any case, the conclusion, I think, is for a lot of people, maybe they just ask this question, maybe God's not really worth our time. Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he's not near enough or powerful enough. Maybe he's not there at all in any case. This has been around for a really long time. You know, Epicurus, you know, think about Epicureanism, Greek philosophy. This is the guy who started that. He asked this question probably 2,500 years ago. Either God wants to abolish evil and cannot, or he can but does not want to. Or he cannot and does not want to. If he wants to but cannot, he's impotent. If he can but does not want to, he is wicked. But if God both can and wants to abolish evil, then how comes evil into the world? And we have some of these answers, but I want us to start thinking about how we can piece them together. I want us to take another small... Getting ahead of myself. There are some assumptions that we make there's some explanations for why we ask these questions and why we come to these conclusions. As has been mentioned earlier, sometimes we're just reacting. Irrationality can be the root of these questions and these thoughts and these conclusions. We're just saying, how can God do this? Because we're just reacting out of pain or fear or confusion. And again, we were talking about this in the college group on Wednesday night. This calls for a high degree of discernment. You know, it's easy for those of us who aren't suffering right now when someone's going through a hard time and asking these hard questions and being like, Job's friends, like, you know, you just need to believe harder, or, you know, some little band-aid, you know, doctrinal response that's not going to help anybody. Sometimes the best thing we can do is just listen. Sometimes we can offer a hug. Sometimes we can actually do something about it. And sometimes they do need a doctrinal response, but that calls for discernment. But I think it's healthy to recognize up front that sometimes when people say these things, they're not really thinking this. They're not really believing this. They just hurt, or they just don't understand, and they're just talking. Two, this is a big one, and I think, I don't want to park here, but it's a really, really simple issue. I don't deserve this. This isn't fair. They feel like God is not being just. The assumption here is, of course, that I deserve better, which, as you've addressed, right? Well, there is original sin, right? There is no such thing as good people. Not in a true theological sense. We can talk, oh, he's a good person, like he's, you know, an upstanding citizen, good father, you know, generous person. But before God, you know, there is none who is good. You know, no, not one, says the scripture. But again, go to that boy on the streets of Mumbai, or, you know, I had a friend who died in a motorcycle accident a few years back. And it's sort of like, yeah, he was a sinner, but people asking that they desire... Do they deserve to live like that? Do they deserve to die like that? Theologically, we can be like, yeah, well, we all just deserve hell, it's sin, blah, 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 blah. You can just say that, but feel the weight of that question when you are actually in that seat and be sensitive. You know, and there's this other big issue, and I think this is where your more academic people are going to go. If there is a God, why doesn't he just do something about it? Because it certainly doesn't look like he's doing anything about it to me. To a lot of people, I think the world seems to be getting worse and worse.
It is.
There's one right there. technologically, we advance, but morally, are we advancing? You know, in terms of poverty, are we advancing? I mean, there's all kinds of things we can analyze, but true or not, there's a definite perception that we feel like we're going downhill and that God is not doing any kind of miraculous intervention to step in, so why doesn't he just do something about it? That's true. But again, what about the boy on the streets in India? You as you sit, may not struggle with this. You may be like, you know, I got the answer in my head. I have dealt with this question, and I have my reasons, and I'm secure. And that's not an arrogant thing to say. It just means you've thought this through, and you've dealt with it, which is a good place to be in. But what about an unbeliever? What about someone who is trying to believe but is struggling through it? It's those of us who have been through Bible school or seminary or something have this... a similar issue. You know, I have a master's in theology, I'm working on an MDiv. And when I teach, there's always this question of, okay, I know this much, but then how do you transfer this into this other body out there? Some of these people know as much as I do, and maybe more. Some of these people might know next to nothing. So how do we translate what I know to be true into something that's going to be useful and helpful for the other people? We can say, well, this is the right answer. Jesus, you know, God, cross. But I want us to talk about, or at least I want you guys to think through, and this is actually going to be a group break. Please take 5 minutes or a few minutes and talk with your discussion partner again. I want you to look each other in the eye. I want you to give an actual answer in actual words. Ask each other, just pick one of these questions each, and just say, look at each other and be like, this is my question. If I were really suffering through something, and if you are, feel free to share if you're comfortable. If you were suffering through something, how would you answer that person? Based on what you know, because you have some great answers over there. I know you guys will probably be all set. But go ahead and do that. Take a few minutes and just say, ask this question to your partner, and then give an actual answer in actual words. How would you respond to somebody? Listen to some of our answers here. If a couple of you are willing to share, yeah. And that's part of the reason for these exercises, is it's very easy for us to pop out an answer. But... like, Patrick pointed out, when you actually think through and really feel what someone else is going through and be like, I have an answer, but again, how do we translate this thing that I know into something that someone else can really use who's really going through this? And who knows? Unbeliever, new believer, it could be you. Maybe you yourself, even though you know the truth, will get totally sidelined when something happens. And then suddenly you're like, I know the pat answer, but it's suddenly not so easy. You know, so I say, use this as you will. If this can improve your understanding, or if nothing else can hone some skills to help equip you, great. However you can use it. And as always, if afterward you feel like, hey, you could have done this better, or maybe you could try this next time, would even be more effective, I'm always, always open for constructive criticism. So that's something I'm always open for. Yes, ma'am.
One thing.
Amen.
It's okay.
It is totally okay.
To move it.
Yep.
And then he's going to take the gentle, kind word, you know.
Absolutely. That's part of the reason why, from week to week, I want to emphasize sitting with someone that you don't necessarily know real well, because maybe I'm a bulldozer and I'm just like, there's the answer. And they're like, that's not how I handle this. Like, my mother-in-law here, Janice, and I do not have the same communication styles. And I'm just sort of like, hit me. Just hit me. And she's like, You know, I can deal with my Aunt Sue back there and sort of like, all right, come on, let's do this. You know, but I know that because I know them, and we can only get a feel for each other. And I know, Lindsay Powell has come to me and said, hey, Josh, I got this coworker who's not a believer. How do I deal with the situation? Maybe you could talk to him. You know, if you know somebody else in this crowd, like, oh, they would probably do real well and connect with this person. You know, maybe I don't have the gifting or personality for that, but somebody else. It will do us well to get a feel for each other for that exact reason. So, yes, Kenneth.
I think it's great.
So let's talk about some solutions. And if we have time when I'm done running through this, I want to get some more feedback. I doubt we'll have time. I always go in and thinking I've got 12 minutes of material, and it ends up being 45. So one of these years I'll get a handle on this. But just as there are not, you know, just one question, there's several ways of looking at this question. There's also several ways of answering it. And like you said, there's different answers, and different things may be effective for everyone else. I want to, if you either give you or help reinforce what you already have in terms of a rational and biblical response that is also satisfactory to our emotional needs here. So this is what I have seen work in the lives of the people. This is what I myself use for my own questions, my own doubts. And if we have time, I'd love to go into what you guys have. And we will have time. We can revisit this next week if you had something you wanted to say. I want us to really flesh this stuff out. Because, again, it's not just trying to vomit information at you so much as giving you some tools is really what we're looking for. So as has been mentioned out there, I really feel like this is one of the big issues, you know. It is impossible to have meaningful human choice without allowing for evil. Lee Strobel, in his book, The Case for Faith, asked the question, how would you have designed the world if you were God? How would you have done it differently? I mean, because, I mean, think about the alternative. God created humanity with the option to sin, thus creating the possibility for evil. God is not the author of sin, but he created the possibility for evil when he gave us free will, and I don't want to go into the theological ramifications of that, depending on what your presuppositions are, but if God forced humans to be perfect, would that not strip us of all purpose, all meaning? In order for our choices to have any real significance, we have to have the option of obeying or not. And I don't know if anyone would disagree with that, but I feel like that's a very firmly established fact. I don't know. There's a lot we don't know about heaven. I mean, I can give you my speculation, but since we're going to be talking about hell in the next couple of weeks, I'll probably save that for discussion for the afterlife, what speculation I do have. But it's a good question, and I don't know that there's a firm answer to it. Point number two, answer number two, we really have no one to blame as ourselves. And I don't mean that, you know, Laura Ashley, you are responsible for that boy on the streets of Mumbai. But there is a broad sense in which, collectively, our sin is what brings the suffering into the world. And this is not just about original sin. Romans 5:8, you know, death entered the sin because of one man's sin. Death entered the world because of one man's sin. You know, Peter Kreeft, he's a Catholic theologian, he makes a very good point. The overwhelming majority of the pain in this world is caused by our choices collectively as a society to kill, to slander, to be selfish, to stray sexually, to break our promises, to be reckless. I mean, think about this. You know, maybe ask yourself this hard question. You know, what have I done to contribute to the misery of the world? Or hopefully maybe the other way around. What have we done to help? So there's original sin. There's our sin. And C.S. Lewis, I like his quote here. He says, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to us in our conscience, but he shouts to us in our pains. Pain is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Our sin and its consequences is our fault as a collective race of humans. But God also is sovereign even in that to call us back and bring some good out of it. And this next point is huge. God is doing something right now in this moment to fix the problem. Obviously, the cross. The cross is where God himself steps into our world. He takes on our sin, and it was crucified with him. Jesus did not heal all the pain of the world when he came, but everywhere he went, you'll notice, he was helping the problem. And then he ended his life and then resurrection with the ultimate triumph over this. The cross serves as the turning point that provides the answer. It is not an argument that is the real answer to this, but a person. Jesus is the answer. It is proof that God is both loving and powerful. Some of this evil that we go through, some of it does lead to a greater good. I would be very careful. Bruce Little, a former pastor here, wrote a couple of good books on this. And he just warns, saying, if you say, well, the greater good theodicy, the greater good defense, that, well, you know, God works all things together for good, therefore that justifies all evil. Well, it's very difficult to demonstrate that there's a one-for-one correspondence, that every bad thing, like what about those limbless children starving on the streets of Mumbai? How does my spiritual growth, even if that occurs from that fact, justify? Like there's this massive imbalance. We have to admit that our sin has created some gratuitous evil. However, there is a glimmer of hope in this even. You know, Jesus learned obedience through suffering. God never promised to keep us free from suffering. But at the same time, if we choose to respond that way, he can bring some growth out of us. That doesn't mean it's going to be material gain, but spiritual gain can come from when difficult situations happen to us. But what I really want to lead to here is we are part of the solution. I don't know how we specifically go help out the boy on the streets of Mumbai, but I bet you that there's somebody out there who's trying who could probably use your time or your money. Acts chapter 2, right? The Christians were all together. They were sharing their things, and they were contributing to the needs of the people around them. And they held favor with God and all the people because of what they were doing. People looked at Christians, and they said, I think it was Herodotus, one of the early historians in Rome, mentioned that early Christians were known for being generous with their money and stingy with their bed, which was the exact inverse of the rest of the population. You know, the cross sets the tone, but we are the outflow. We are Christ's body. And since we're out of time, I just got to get to my point here. Romans 8:18. God promises that the pain will be worth it. He says, I reckon that the sufferings of the present time are not worth comparing to the glory that will be revealed in us. You know, if I told you, if I slapped you in the face, I'd give you $1 billion, would you be like, yeah, I guess that's okay. You know, that's what we're saying. Like the Holocaust, all the suffering, these boys in the streets of Mumbai, all the terrible things in this world. He says, for those who believe, and this is part of the reason why the gospel is so critical to get out there, God has to allow people the choice to disobey, but he's also provided the mechanism for them to turn back to him. And for those who will, there is this answer. It will all be worth it. And finally here, ending with this case study on Job. You all know the story. He's worshiping God. He's pure of heart. And yet God allows Satan to just blow him and his whole family away. And he's suffering and his friends are yelling at him. And what's the point of the book? What does Job really communicate to us? The point of Job is not that Satan is behind all of our temptations and trials. He's probably behind some of them, but that's not the point. The point is rather that God is in control. You know that God lets Satan do what he does. Satan has to come and ask God. So even if Satan is involved, God is still in control, and God still cares about us, and God has purpose in our pain, even if we never find out the exact answer to the question why. And finally, God will restore to us many times over all that we have lost for him in this world for the sake of following him. So that's all I have. Those are four issues. And again, those answers are that it is impossible to live in a world without evil. God has to allow it for our choices to have significance. Two, we took that choice and we disobeyed and we brought the suffering into the world collectively as a race. And yet three, God is doing something about it anyway, and we are part of that solution. And in the end, he promises that all of the pain, again, the slap in the face and the $1 billion, all of the pain in this world will be worth it because of the cross. So that is the answer the Bible gives. And you can speculate and you can contribute how you want from there on out, but we're out of time for today. If you are interested in further reading, of course, there are some great books with some authors. I recommend reading to look further into it. I'm going to go ahead and close this in prayer, and we will get you guys out of here. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you that we have the minds to process these difficult questions, but you don't leave us hanging. We have some answers from your word. Thank you for the cross. Thank you for the opportunity to be part of the solution. I ask that you would give us strength as we go out along those exact lines of thought and action. We ask this in the name of Christ. Amen.